Hello and good evening on day two of the Chaos Communication Camp 2023. It's late in the evening. This is Milliway Stage, in case you're wondering. And the next talk is going to be about incident responses. So if you're curious about how do you even get there to have an incident response, how you could prepare for an incident response, and how you could support in your organization the incident response team in doing their job and trying to fix whatever broke, let's put it that way, we have the right talk for you. This is Stories from the Life of an Incident, from Incident Responders. Harry and Chris, please, a very warm round of applause.
So, good evening. Thank you for joining us today. We will tell you a little bit of our life as incident responders. And I'm Chris. I did my computer science studies at the University of Erlangen-Nuremberg. I do this security stuff for over 10 years now, so my CV is a little bit longer. At the moment, I'm a detection engineer. Before that, I was a long time working in DFIR, so digital forensic incident response in different organizations. And
yeah, I'm Harry. I studied electrical and computer engineering at RWTH Aachen University. And I played a lot of CTF and did some hacking stuff at Chaos Computer Club Aachen. During my master's, I worked at X41DSEC doing pen testing and patch analysis. So I also have some kind of offensive security background, and for around 1 year now, I'm working at GData Advanced Analytics, doing digital forensics and incident handling. First, Christian will give you a short introduction, and then he will tell you how a classical ransomware attack looks like. And in the second part of the talk, I will tell you how the incident responders work and what you can do in advance to make it go as smooth as possible and support the incident response team.
So as Harry told you, we'll talk about ransomware because the customers we usually have are small and medium-sized businesses, universities and hospitals, and those are unfortunately regularly hit by ransomware gangs. The main reason for this, and that's if you heard the last talk, why they maybe not that responsive and are not so interested in, they just lack the resources, so the manpower to do proper security measurements, to secure their systems, especially in situations where you are, for example, in a hospital, have medical devices where you cannot simply install an AV on or even patch the system because you lose the certification as a medical device then. But also in companies, manufacturing companies, on the shop floor, we are talking about systems that have runtimes of 25 plus years. So if you look back now, 2023, we're talking about XP and older systems. Fun fact, I was in a ransomware case in a WannaCry in 2017 when I got a call from a person from the shop floor asking me if we have an NT4 expert that can tell us if WannaCry is affecting NT4. Of course, you don't need to be expert on NT4 in this. WannaCry is, of course, not affecting NT4 systems. So due to the time slot, we thought memes are the best way to tell you those stories. And we have a lot of them. So in the first section, I tell you a little bit of how an attack works. There a lot of different possibilities how you can describe and how to structure how an attack works. There's the MITRE ATT&CK framework, for example. There was a talk yesterday by Meika Sauko here on the stage. There's the original cyber kill chain from Lockheed Martin. You have stuff from companies like Mandiant, their targeted attack lifecycle. But that's all, in my opinion, too fine-grained. It's, that's the reason I just take three simple steps. Yeah, get a foothold in the door, look, move, play around, and cash out. Those three I will just go over. So start with get a foot in the door. So normally we see three ways how attackers can get into the environment in the, ransomware cases. You have vulnerabilities in remote or internet-facing systems. You have the remote services itself, and you have malware. Starting with the vulnerabilities, and I just looked up the last 4 years. And maybe somebody remembers NetScaler, the so-called Citrix vulnerability in December 2019. It was released mid of 2019, December 2019. The first POC, publicly available POC, was in beginning of January, and the patch was available in mid of January. So there was around 1 week to 1.5 weeks between a public proof of concept for the vulnerability and a patch for the vulnerability. And what we saw during 2020, a lot of companies patched, but the patch didn't remove the compromise. So they were already compromised, and yeah, with the patch, they didn't remove the compromise. So what we found, what we could provable see or prove evidence for was 9 months. Customer was breached after 9 months using this vulnerability. And we had other customers where we could see that the NetScaler was affected after 2 years. But we couldn't prove that this this compromise was the reason for the actual ransomware case. And of course, such vulnerabilities happen not that often. Yeah, so 2021 gave us Hafnium exchange vulnerability. Also a similar situation. The patch appeared as an out-of-band patch from Microsoft on a Tuesday evening, 10 o'clock in German time. We saw during our incidents or the assessments we did that the first exploitation attempts were seen on Wednesday in the morning at 5 a.m. So around 7-8 hours later. I know one guy who could patch because he was online when the patch was released. Otherwise, Germany was unable to patch in time. And of course, we can go on with 2021. Proxy shell also exchange vulnerability. Proxy not shell also exchange vulnerability. We have in 2022 VMware Horizon, the virtual desktop infrastructure from VMware. Just to name also open source stuff, Zimbra, a collaboration platform including an email server, had a vulnerability. Actually, the vulnerability was in CPIO from 2015, I think, which led to a compromise using via email. So you send an email with a CPIO with a specially crafted archive file, and you could drop a web shell in one of the directories. Yeah, you have, of course, FortiOS, which is the FortiGate VPN and firewall operating system. And if you read the news, we start at the beginning again. NetScaler had some issues several weeks ago. According to Fox IT, we have 1,900 still unpatched NetScalers worldwide. How many patched NetScalers exist that have not been checked for compromise. We don't know, of course. So that will be a nice year, probably. So what can you do against this kind of attack vector? Patch your systems is one thing. As you see, that doesn't lead to or what you need to do afterwards in such cases. You need to check your systems for possible compromise. That is important. To reduce this, I highly suggest put your services behind some VPN, so that only people who already have connection to the VPN can access your services or the services they need. And that would reduce the attack surface, at least to the VPN server. So, but of course, we can also think about remote services without vulnerabilities. There can be configuration mistakes, so the admin does something wrong. There can be insecure default configurations like this. I don't know if you know it, but the local admins or the administrators on a Windows system are automatically in the remote desktop users group. And so we had several cases, especially in the beginning of the pandemic, when everybody moved from to the home offices, and they needed to put people fast in the position to access the internal systems again. They just put a RDP server on the internet and hope for the best. Additionally, if you put services on the internet, of course, brute forcing and credential stuffing are attacks that are possible. So brute forcing, just trying the username and password combinations, credential stuffing, using already leaked passwords or credentials from leaks you find on the internet. What you can do about this kind of attack vector is just, as I said, use multi-factor authentication and reduce the attack surface, as in the point with the vulnerabilities before, by moving the services behind a VPN, and then use multi-factor authentication on the VPN, of course. The last vector that we see normally that attackers can get in the network is malware. We all know this about those funny emails you get with the attachments, have either Word documents attached, either zip files with Visual Basic scripts, JavaScripts, and what you can get, ISOs, you see a lot these days. Or what you can also have, that you can have just a link inside the email and you download the respective file from some shady file sharing website. What we saw over the last year was USB sticks again, funnily. I'm not sure if you have heard about Raspberry Robin, which is a malware that worms via USB sticks. But I haven't seen it as a vector for ransomware yet on my own. But there are people who said that it's an initial access broker for some of the ransomware gangs. So what can you do about this? If you think you can, of course, ban simply some file extensions in your mail server, or you change the file association types in your operating system, meaning that you don't open the JavaScript and Visual Basic script files using, for example, the Windows scripting host, but open it with Notepad. And that will, of course, some people will be some people will think about what this is then and ask the IT guys, but it's better than running the script itself. One thing I don't like to say it, but keep your AV updated. This is one thing, keep it updated and read the logs. We see a lot of incidents where we see that already days or weeks before you could have seen that there's something going on in your network. And if you see malware in your AV logs, then react to it. Just check it. You don't know how long this AV, this malware has been on your system. The thing is that just because your AV detected it now, it might have been received an update for its signatures, and the malware was active for days or weeks before. So when they are inside, then they usually look, move, and play around a little bit. So when they look around, what they do is they enumerate AD, they do port scans, they search for vulnerabilities, they check how they can escalate their privileges. They try to find credentials. Kerber roasting, we heard in the talk before, for example, is this one thing. They try to identify accounts you have running on your systems. They can use, they can get the credentials from and reuse. And for that reason, one of the most important things I think is that you have a principle of least privileges in your environment. So only what an account needs, you should be able to do. You should use dedicated service accounts for your services, of course. And just for your information, a service account is not an account that has a SVC underscore in front of it and is otherwise a normal user account. There exist dedicated service accounts in Windows environments. So use them. Use strong passwords. I know companies who still use 8-character long passwords. I think that's 20 minutes on a decent graphics card today. So use strong passwords. Length matters. 12 plus characters is the minimum, in my opinion. And don't reuse passwords. Especially on your systems, the local administrator, especially in small and medium-sized businesses, you see a lot that people use the same password for all local administrators. So if I have it on one system, I have the whole company. Don't reuse it. So when they move around in your network using either password hashes they found, valid credentials they discovered somewhere, vulnerabilities are also used to move around in your environment. They try to establish persistence mechanisms. Yeah, we heard also in the talk before about the C2 channels, command and control channels they use. They install, in some cases, directly any desk, team viewer, or other remote control software. Or sometimes they also use tunneling softwares like ngrok, or recently they started using Cloudflare G. And this is what you need to do is have a proper network segmentation. And with the proper network segmentation, I don't talk about subnetting. Subnetting means you just have different subnets. You need to have a firewall between them, and you need to have rules between them that restrict access between your subnets. And one thing is especially important, please keep or use network segmentation to restrict the access to your backup and your management systems as far as possible. We see a lot, especially as I said, in the small and medium-sized businesses or in the other organizations we have as customers, that yeah, they have, they tell us in workshops, yeah, we have network segmentation. Every building is one segment, and on the question, yeah, you can move between in a segment, you can access everything. Yes, you can, and between the buildings, you have also a firewall, and you cannot access anything. No, you can access everything. And also your VMware management console. Oh yes, yes, we can. So everybody can access it. Yes, of course. And that doesn't work. So when they play around, they normally try to gain more privileges. So privilege escalation is a thing. Local privilege escalations normally, but also using vulnerabilities or misconfigurations, insecure default configurations. My personal favorites are group policy preferences or passwords in group policy preferences. This is no longer possible since, I think, 2014 to put passwords in group policy preferences. However, if you had your password stored in those preferences before the patch in 2014, then they're still there. And yeah, they are AES encrypted, but the encryption key is on the Microsoft website. So you can just download it, just take it and decrypt the keys. During that phase, they also try to disable your security measures. The thing you can do is, of course, patch your systems. So try to get your vulnerabilities out of this equation. Try to configure your systems in a secure way. This is not always possible due to some shitty third-party software. And keep your AV updated, and please, please, as I said already, check the logs and act accordingly. So in the last phase, they cash out. That's when they start using being your backup service. So they copy data from your environment using file sharing platforms, for example. Yeah, Mega NZ was once a thing. WeTransfer, we had already. Every other file sharing platform you can think about is a possible way to exfiltrate data. They also use their C2 communication channels. So sometimes they just use the possibilities in AnyDesk or in RDP clients. Or they use file transfer protocols like SFTP. We saw, for example, in one case that they tried to install FileZilla on every machine they had access to, because on the first one it didn't work, on the second it didn't work, on the third it didn't work yet because SFTP was blocked outgoing. And that is one of the things you can do to prevent exfiltration, block at least protocols you know that you don't need in your environment. And proper network segmentation, of course, is a general a thing. So in the last step, that's when they start your encryption. They're running the ransomware. Normally, they have domain admins at that point, so they can run it on all domain-connected systems. They can also disable, of course, when they are domain admin, they can disable the AV before they start the ransomware. Ransomwares today disable services like databases and such things so that they have the full power of the machine for the encryption. if you get lucky, not everything works perfectly because they use group names, and Windows is especially picky when you have a non-English Windows installed. For example, in Germany, the group everybody is called Jeder. And we had our, cases where the ransomware didn't really work that well because they couldn't change the permissions of the files first. They use different encryption schemas. Normally, they come with an asymmetric and a symmetric encryption type. The asymmetric, so public key cryptography, the public key comes with the ransomware and is used to encrypt the symmetric keys they generate in your environment. Depending on the ransomware, they generate one key for each system or even one key for each file. It depends a little bit on the ransomware, how it works, but that's the usual thing they use. I would never count on the fact that there are possibly, maybe, there could be decryptable things. In my world, the ransomware gangs have learned and use the standard Microsoft Windows or some other publicly available libraries to do their encryption. They execute it via remote tools like PSEXEC, PowerShell, or some use GPOs, group policies, to execute the ransomware on every machines they connected to the domain. And what can you do about this? It's hard, but the most important thing is have online backups, offline backups. Sorry. You see, online backups are great, but not that great. Offline backups is the most important thing. So, don't have it connected to your environment. The USB disk on a system is not an offline backup. In my opinion, if you see that something is still encrypting. I'm always hesitant to say shut down the system, because you can break the encryption and maybe the file that is currently under encryption or the files will never be decryptable if you want to buy a decryptor or get a decryptor through some discussions with the ransomware guys. If it's a VM, just suspend it. And that's it. And if everything is already encrypted, keep cool and call your incident responder.
So now let's talk about incident response. What happens when it's already too late? And what can you do to support your incident response team? At first, the things I'll say in this chapter are for our company and how we work, so other companies might work a little bit different than that. First, for some reason, incidents always come on Friday afternoon. So some customers think it is a good idea to try to solve a case by themselves, maybe until the end of the week, and if they didn't solve it until the end of the week, they call the incident response team. Please don't do that. It doesn't help your company, and it doesn't make your incident response team happy to have to work on the weekend. And in addition, the longer you wait with calling the incident response team, the longer the incident response will take, and the more complicated forensics will be, because you have log retention times while trying to do stuff by yourself. Maybe you modify some of the systems and it becomes much more harder to do precise forensics. So what happens on our side when such a new incident ticket arrives? The first thing we do is team internal coordination. So we discussed, do we have enough people? Do we have a person for each role? In our team, we have three roles: incident handling, forensics analyst, and malware analyst. So first, let's talk about incident handling. Incident handler is responsible for all the tasks that are customer facing. And the first point is always get the customer out of that headless chicken mode, like we call it. Because when an incident comes at our customer side, everyone is like running around in circles like headless chicken, doing something but not doing anything helpful. So this is always the first task for the incident handler. Handlers structure the customer, do meetings, and then do all the relevant decisions, leading to a secure emergency operation mode. That means in this case that you have working core infrastructure, so working domain controller, maybe a working email server, and whatever you need or whatever you define as very business critical systems. Let's go a little bit more in detail. Probably the first measure will be to cut off the internet connection, because you just buy you a lot of time with doing that. No matter how many backdoors the attackers placed in the network, if you cut off the internet connection, the attackers can't access their backdoors anymore. And then you will start to rebuild your network. You will define everything in your current infrastructure as red network, and then start building up a green network with clean systems. Maybe you will start with some admin workstations so that the administrators can work properly. And then we go through a prioritized system list and build up the most important systems. This can be, of course, like I said, domain controllers or email servers, but also whatever is important for your current company and for the business. This is, of course, in a hospital, something very different from a small business or maybe a university. And please have such a prioritized list before your first incident. Because when you start discussing in an incident which system is the most important, then everyone in the company will tell you something else. And everyone will tell you that their system is the most important and has to be migrated and checked and analyzed at first, and this isn't really helpful. So during incident handling, there might also be obstacles. For example, if you have backups and you encrypted your backups, this is great. But you should think about where to store that encryption key. Because when you store it in your password manager, and the password manager database is in a VM, which then gets encrypted by the ransomware, well, you have backups, but you don't have your key to decrypt the backup, so this doesn't help you very much. And this is not only true for password, this is also true for like everything else which you could need during an incident, like contact lists or network lists and so on. So working with third parties is also a task for the incident handler. This could be a data protection agency or the customer's customers, because they also often have some panic and have questions which the customer maybe can't answer. So this is also a task for the incident handler. And of course, also working with law enforcement. But there's one thing to keep in mind. Law enforcement wants to do a criminal investigation. Incident response wants to bring you back to business as soon as possible. This is not necessarily the same goal, but it definitely makes sense to allow your incident responders to share all information with law enforcement, because this is beneficial for everyone. So why do I do forensics at all, one could ask? Well, the less precise the forensic results are, the more conservative the rebuild needs to be. So if you don't know anything about the attack, you have to rebuild everything from scratch. So let's say you have maybe 2-week-old backups, and you know the initial access of the attackers was only 1 week ago. Then you could use that 2 weeks old backups for rebuilding, which is really great. But if you don't know how long the attackers were in the network, then it's really hard to say. A second point why you should do forensics is to estimate the impact, especially in an early phase of an attack, it is important to know, did the attackers only compromise some user devices, or did they already gain domain administrative privileges? Because then the incident handling is completely different. And of course, it is also relevant to know which attack path the attackers used, so you can harden your network and improve in the future. How should forensics be? It should, of course, be correct. It should be non-disruptive for the customer, so that they can concentrate on rebuilding their infrastructure, and it should be fast. What means correct? You want to have a dedicated forensics analyst, so you want to have incident response team, which is doing incident response in their day-to-day business. And you want in your forensics teams one person who can really concentrate on forensics and is not also doing the incident handling and the malware analysis and so on, because then you can't really concentrate on doing the technical work. It also should be non-disruptive, as I said. That means for our company, we do remote triage collection. We use the tool Velociraptor for it. This is an unofficial logo of Velociraptor. It's a really nice tool because we just send our customers an EXE file. The customer just has to execute the EXE file, and then it collects all the logs we need, all the information we need, and uploads it to our infrastructure, so we don't need to drive to the customer and like start copying hard disks for weeks, because this doesn't help anyone. I should also said it should be fast, so we have a lot of automation and tooling to make the work really fast, automatically pushing the uploaded files to our analysis infrastructure, automatically doing reporting and so on. I won't go in detail here because this is enough for a single talk about it, maybe on Congress, let's see. So what happens when we do manual forensic analysis? There are some questions you normally want to answer. One is, of course, about the backdoors. You want to find all backdoors the attackers placed in the network. Of course, you want to have general IOC, so indicators of compromise. So maybe which IP addresses did the attackers use, so you can block them in the firewall, or which tools did they use, so you can scan over the whole IT infrastructure and find further compromised systems. And if you have the IOCs, you can also cross-correlate between cases or share them with law enforcement. Another important thing is, of course, lateral movement, because you can use lateral movement to build a timeline of the attack. So the methodology here is to look where the attackers came from and where the attackers went. So if you have a system A and you see the attackers came from system B, then you analyze system B and go back in time. And the same you could do forward in time until you found all relevant systems which were compromised and have a proper timeline of the case. Another common thing in the life of an incident responder is to fall in a rabbit hole, because it can be really, really interesting to do forensics. But you need to check what the customer really wants to know, or what your incident handler really wants to know, and not just analyze something and fall into the rabbit hole, because this really doesn't help anyone. Here also the 80-20 rule applies, so I'd say you get like 80% of the relevant forensics results in 20% of the time, and often this is enough for the incident handler to do the right decisions to rebuild the customer's networks as fast as possible. So let's go into reporting. Nobody really likes reporting, but producing fancy forensics results, doing fancy technical stuff, is worthless if you can't explain it to a manager. Nobody pays us to do fancy technical stuff nobody understands, but we are paid to help our customers and explain the situation to them and to do the right decisions. So nobody likes reporting, but it is a really, really important thing. So after delivering the report, the incident is over and all work is done, right? No, not really, because such a report normally contains a lot of recommendations what to do for the customers. And as I already said, incident response more or less stops when the customer is in an emergency operation mode with the core infrastructure and the most critical systems working, but there's still a lot to do. And of course, security is a process, so there's always something to improve to stay ahead of the attackers. So now let's go into a quick recap.
How to protect against those kind of attacks. Yeah? We had these the topics just as a recap. Patch your systems, it's important. Keep them updated. Vulnerabilities come and go. That's one thing. Have a sane privilege account management. So use the correct user accounts for the right task. Use the second two-factor authentication for remote services. Have a proper network segmentation. So put firewalls and access rules between your networks. Check your AV logs regularly and act accordingly. And not really protecting you against an attack, but keeping the symptoms a little bit not that devastating. Have offline backups.
So, how to make incident response easier for you, for yourself, and for the incident response team? First thing is, don't try to solve the stuff by yourself. Just call the incident response team of your trust as soon as you know you have an incident. The second thing is logging policy. Because if you have a very short log retention, for example, and you only have logs for the last like 2 days, then it might be hard to find out what happened. And if you don't log stuff at all, especially in the cloud environments, this is a thing where you need to look at, then it might also be hard to get proper forensic results. Then, as I said, have offline contact lists, because your mail server is down, your accounts are compromised, so you can't use like your Microsoft Teams or whatever you use in your company. You need an alternative way to communicate to your colleagues and or employees. Then, as I said, prioritize asset list and network plans and a disaster recovery plan in best case. And please all have all that in a secure place, in best case on paper. Well, nobody likes doing stuff with dead trees, I know, but dead trees don't get ransomware, right? So that's it from our side, more or less. Normally this is the point where you can ask us questions, but we want to spin that around and give you some questions. Maybe someone can guess the right answer. What do you think is the shortest time to domain admin? We saw an incident between initial compromise and the attackers gaining domain admin.
2 minutes.
Yeah, it's not. Somebody said 17 seconds, 2 minutes. Well, it's not that bad. 6 minutes is what we have seen in the incident. What do you think is the shortest log retention on a domain controller? So how long?
Zero?
10 hours, I hear? Well, it is 2.5 minutes.
Eine Minute.
What do you think is the highest number of domain administrator accounts we saw in an incident? 200? Nah. 50? 64? With 120 people working in IT? What do you think is the longest dwell time? So the longest time between being initially compromised and realizing that you are compromised. 60, nah, it's not that bad. I hear a lot of years. Well, it is like around 2 years. So now that's really it from our side.
No time for questions, thank you. If you have questions, we will be there outside waiting. Come and join us.
Thank you, Harry and Chris. Warm round of applause. Thank you.